Three. What kind of a figure did André Marty cut?
Well, there was this man in a big fur coat, you see, and haranguing us all in French. And my schoolboy French at that stage was just schoolboy French. Later on, I did learn quite a lot of French and Spanish, but incidentally, I had taken with me a Hugo's Spanish in 3 months. That was the only book I took with me to Spain because I thought I might need it. And you know, we kind of, and then of course the finale, of course, was everybody singing the International in French fists, and then we marched away. You see.
But how much did people understand?
Well, it didn't matter. You know what I mean? Because you've got this international solidarity, etc. You know, it's, the words came through almost in an international language. And outside, we got into trucks and were driven away to a village outside Albacete. This was these names.
Doesn't matter.
Madrigueras. And there, an English-speaking collection was forming. There were Dutch, there was Cypriot, there was an Egyptian, and the Irish. And of course we still had, you know, just no idea what we were going to do or anything like that. We still had our civilian clothes, the same civilian clothes that we'd been sleeping in before. And the only training we ever got was to count off in threes, and then number one steps forward, number three steps back, and number two stays where he is, and when you turn right, you're in a column of three. And that's what we used to practice doing, and then we would go across the that part of Spain is a sort of very heavy clay, pebbly soil where they grow the vines, and we would march across these fields and try to form what they called arrowhead formation, with one in front, one behind, and every three would do this to form a three, you see. And then at the cry of Albion, we would drop down and try to bury ourselves in the ground. We never had any weapon training of any kind. We never saw any weapons.
Had you had any weapon training in the Manchester?
In Manchester, when I was in the Territorial Army as a boy, I had once gone out to the firing range at Croydon and had fired five shots from a rifle, but that was the only time I'd ever fired a gun.
From a 303?
From a 303, yes. Anyway, apart from that, the main activity was discussion, you know, of talking, why you're here, where are you from, and what have you been doing, and so on. And then there was a controversy. The leader of the group was supposed to be Wilfred McCartney. Now, Wilfred McCartney was an author who had written a book called Walls Have Ears. Walls Have Mouths. I think he had been imprisoned for sedition. And coming over with our group was a Jewish man with a very military sort of bearing from London. And he had been part of the Jewish ex-servicemen's group. His name was George Nathan. And he had been a warrant officer in the First World War and remained in the army and had been given a commission and had gone out to Ireland with the Black and Tans. And of course, this caused controversy because it was suggested that George was the only one who had any real military knowledge or experience, and therefore he should be in charge. But a number of the Irishmen, you know, we don't want this black and tan anyway, you know.
Did they say that to his face?
Oh yes, right to his face. Well, I mean, these were discussions, you know. And
so how did he react?
Well, there was a case that one day when one man suggested the right thing to do is to have a vote and to elect our officers. And George said, "That's all very well," he said, "but we have come to offer our services to the Spanish army. So we can't tell the Spanish army how they should run their business. We have volunteered to join their army. They don't ask them to join ours. So we've got to obey the kind of laws that they are, and therefore we cannot elect our own officers. It would be much better if those who were put in charge had your confidence. But obviously, popularity vote is not the best way of choosing the right man. You've got to choose it from experience." He said, "And I've got experience." And eventually this was accepted. And it was a good thing too, because George was, well, he saved the company many, many times, you know, which could have been drastic if it hadn't been for his cool-headedness. Anyway, this was how things were going on, and still no sign of guns or any part training or anything of this kind.
What was McCartney like?
McCartney, we didn't see much of him, you know. Eventually, he injured himself playing with his rifle or playing with his pistol and went home.
Were you there when it happened?
No, I wasn't there when it happened, but, you know, everybody knew what had happened. The other man there was Tom Winchingham, of course, and Tom Winchingham, he became the battalion commander afterwards. But before then, you see, it must have been coming towards the end of December, coming towards Christmas. Because actually we went into action on Christmas Day in the Cordova front.
Excuse me, coming back to McCartney, did he shoot himself or did somebody else shoot him?
No, I think that two of them, the story we heard was that somebody had admired his gun and he was prepared to do an exchange with it, you know. And in making the exchange, the trigger had gone off, because very few of them really had experience of guns and what to do with them and how to deal with it. And I think he only got a wound in his hand. You know, it wasn't really serious.
Who was the other person?
I have no idea who the other person was.
Sorry, you were saying about Christmas Day.
Well, before Christmas Day, I had got to know the Dutchmen who were becoming part of this English-speaking group, because English was another language for them, and it was the better for them to be with us than with anybody else. And one of these Dutchmen was Piet Jansen, who was a merchant navy officer, and he had a very big command of languages. He was even to the extent of Chinese and that sort of thing, but most of the, you know, Russian and Bulgarian and so on. And he and I were detailed off to take a truck and go and fetch the uniforms. In the meantime, of course, we had been wandering up and down these clay fields, dropping flat and still wearing the same clothes that we'd come from England in. The same shoes. I had those pointed toe shoes which were then beginning to fall off my feet and so on. So off we went to Aldersating, and we came back with a truck loaded like a jumble sale with all odd clothing in the back. Odd pieces of clothing, trousers, blousons, khaki, black, green, all kinds of stuff, tropical fruit, and the whole thing was just a huge pile like a jumble sale. And everybody was told to sort something out for themselves in order to make some sort of a uniform. And of course, as I say, I'm not sure whether we look more bizarre after changing into uniform than we did with our clothing, the clothing that we'd had before.
Didn't they have somebody to dish it out?
No, just everybody just pile it onto the floor and come in and pick out, and if you think it's going to fit, then you put it on and so on. And a few days after this, we were told that we were going to be formed into a company and go into action. And as I say, we still haven't had any rifle training. We've never seen a rifle. Eventually, we were all marched off, got onto trucks, went off to the railway station, got onto a train, travelled all night, and early next morning, we arrived in a warmer climate. The general opinion was this was Anduja, near on the southern front, going towards Cordoba. And as we marched out of the station, we went into a looked like a warehouse or garage of some kind, and all the way around the room were cases with rifles, and in the middle of the room was a big pile of cartridges, some in clips, some loose, and these boxes were all open, and each man had to go around and take one of these rifles out. These were very old rifles. On the stock was a brass plate which says 1866, 1876, something like that. They were single loaders, but some of them were a bit later and they had a small sort of magazine that you could fit in, but most of them were single loaders. And all the cartridges that were all on the floor in the middle were all different calibers. Some were rimmed, some were rimless. And you just had to sort of take pockets full of these and hope for the best. We marched outside, and as we marched out of the town, we'd also been given some bits of rag because these things were full of full of grease. They'd never been really unpacked, and so they were still thick with grease. One or two blokes found a pull through, mostly rubbish. And we marched through the town, and as we marched out of the town, coming into the town was a long, long stream of refugees. So we knew we were somewhere near the front. You know, it was just this long stream of people coming down, and as they passed, they sort of gave the clenched fist salute, but that was about as much. You know, they were all really very, very tired refugees coming from the fighting zone. So that night we slept on the side of the road and tried to clean our rifles and get ready for whatever was to come. Now, in the meantime, an Irishman came over to me and he said, "I understand you've been in the Territorial Army." So I said, "Well, only as a drummer boy." He said, "Have you ever seen a Sten gun?" "No, no, not a Sten gun."
Thompson gun.
The one with the round top on the middle.
Thompson gun.
No, not the Thompson. There was the
Lewis gun.
The Lewis gun, yes. "Have you ever seen a Lewis gun?" I said, "I've seen one." He said, "Well, I've got this French chassis gun, and it had a magazine which was a quarter of a circle, and inside was a big W spring to pushing the bullets forward." He said, "This is all right," he said, "but every so often one of the bullets comes out of line and it won't fire." He said, "So I need somebody to lie at my side, and when that happens, to take the magazine off and put another magazine and then straighten that bullet out so that it will fire again." He said, "Will you do that? Will you act as a number two?" So I said, "All right." So then he put on me about six of these magazines. And they were about that big, you know, round. And they were
about 8 inches across?
That far, like that, and they were that way.
About a foot.
You see? And they were all pushed up, and he would twist the gun round. We practiced during the night, you see, and he would twist the gun round, and I would take one out and bung the other one in. And then he would turn it back again. And so I got this very old rifle. I got my pockets stuffed with bullets. And I got six or seven of these things tied around my neck, you know, clanking along. And so the next morning we went back to the road and got onto trucks. And set off up the road. But then we heard the sound of an airplane, and the next minute we all told to get out of the trucks, take cover in the side of the road, and the airplane came down and strafed both sides of the road and the truck. And this was our first casualty, and then that Stephen was killed by the strafing then. We all got back in and up the road a bit further until the patrol stopped us, and then we had to get out and into the olive groves. And somewhere Nathan had got himself a little swagger stick, and so he was leading us on. And every so often in the olive groves you'd hear that zip, zip. And leaves would fall, and the general opinion was that these were bullets coming through, and we were very, very close to wherever the fighting was. And we got so far, and then Nathan stopped us and said, in another few yards, he said, there's a clearing and then there's a hill. He said, I want you to, when I say go, come out of the clearing, yelling like mad, and go up that hill. He said, there's some machine guns on top there. He said, well, I think the surprise, he said, I think we can get rid of them. And we did this, and we all dashed out like excited schoolboys, yelling and shouting like mad, and dashed up this hill. And eventually we did frighten them off. And so we took their places on the hill, and then we followed after them. And we seemed to spend most of the day doing this, just chasing after these men, stopping, exchanging fire with them, then advancing again. And in that area, there is no sort of dusk. One moment it's light, the next moment it's pitch black. In addition to that, in the daytime, it's really hot, you know, scorching sun. But the moment the night comes, everything is freezing again. So we are... night came and we're sort of trying. The other thing was that all of this area is planted with olive trees, and each olive tree had a ditch all the way round it to save the water which dropped from the trees and sort of made it like a saucer, sending it all back in again. So we tried to use this sort of terrain as some sort of cover, you know, sort of digging a little bit with our hands and so on. I can't remember, but I think that somewhere in the excitement of, I mean, this shot gun that this man had, would fire about five bullets and then would jam and I would change it and so on. And I think that somewhere in this excitement, I had got up leaving my rifle on the ground. So I was just now, you know, no rifle, just these clanking. Anyway, I got another rifle, and the following morning, during the night, we are told that we are now approaching the village of Lochra, and all of this comes sort of second, third hand, you know, one tells one, the other tells another, and so on. Up to then, I can't think that we'd had more than two or three casualties. So the the plan was that the next morning we would advance to the outskirts of Lopera during the night, before dawn, wait until dawn, and then there would be an artillery barrage, and then we would enter the village. So, in the night, still dark, almost feeling away, we went forward and we came to a rise, and at the top of this rise, we all lay down, waiting for this artillery barrage. Then the sun came up, started warming our backs, and still no sign of anything, not a shot or anything, nothing happening anywhere. And we found that we were on one side of the valley, and on the other side of the valley, we could see the fascists bringing their machine guns up. But still, we had to lie down there. They were too far away for us to fire on. There's no way in which we, with our old guns, there's nothing we could do about it. And we just lay there. In the meantime, joining us had been four men, four Britishers, who had come from Madrid. They had been fighting with the Tyrants. One of these was Jock Cunningham. The other one was John Cornford. You know the poet?
Yes.
Now, Cornford had a bandage round his head, a white bandage round his head, and I thought, I noticed this, as being a stupid thing to do, because there we were, trying to hide ourselves, and he was wearing a white bandage round his head, and of course he was quite a Byronist figure, he was young, he was slim, and this bandage round his head. Jock Cunningham, of course, was a completely different type. And
in what way?
Well, Jock Cunningham was a docker. He was tough and really the very opposite of John Cornford. He was a poet.
But was he wounded in the head?
John Cornford, according to had been wounded. Whether it was in the head, there was some sort of a wound there, whether it was a bullet wound or stone or what, I don't know. There were two others besides him. I can't remember their names, but they were the four of them were there up there with Nathan. Frank Ryan didn't come out with us to Opera. The Irishman, I think it was MacDade who was in charge of the Irishman then. Anyway, we're waiting for this artillery barrage to start, and the sun's getting higher and higher, and in the end, we're just fidgeting, when is it going to start, when is it going to start? And then suddenly it started, but it wasn't our artillery, it was their artillery, and they were dropping their shells just behind us, and then they started sending over air-bursting shrapnel. And you could hear it, burst in the air and then zip from it, sending up the bits of earth and so on. And that's when George Nathan thought, that's it, we've had enough. There is no way in which we can get into Lopera now. And so he gave the order to retreat. But as far as he was concerned, don't rush, don't bunch. Gradually draw back to the olive groves. Because by then, the machine guns that had been set up on the other side of the valley, they were firing as well. One shell burst right close to us, and my colleague, the Irishman with the chassis, he was hit. I took his gun off him and tried to lift him up, but it was no use. But fortunately, two stretcher bearers came from nowhere, and they put him on the stretcher, and away we went. So we fought a retreat for the whole of that day. And by the time we'd finished, we were in that original trench on the top of a hill that we'd taken the day before. and we were there, we were managing to hold on to that. And we knew they were close because the artillery stopped. You know, we knew the enemy was close because the artillery was stopped, and it was probably too close. But we stayed up there all night. Then the next day, the whole battle had shifted. You know, we were still up there, but there was no sign of any battle going on anywhere at all. The troops which were opposing us had all been pulled away and gone somewhere else. What we didn't know is that there'd been a counterattack, and therefore, you know, the whole battle had shifted. Because we must have been like guerrilla groups, small forces here and there, you see. And so we pulled back into a place where we could, onto a sunken road where we were all sort of got some food. Because we'd been without food all day, you see. We'd just been fighting, and all that we got was whatever we'd managed to put in our pockets during the day. And so then we just spent the rest of that day just resting, not knowing what had been happening. The next day, we moved a bit farther away, and by that time, I was joined with Pete Janssen, the man at the Dutchman, who had... The Dutchman who had come with me to get the uniforms and so on, we'd become pally. And along came Nathan, and he picked out four of us to go on a recce to move forward to see if we could find out where the enemy were. So there were two parties of four. Pete Janssen wasn't amongst them. He was he stayed behind, but I was one. And one of the other Dutchmen came with me. Now, we didn't have any watches, we didn't have any compass, and this was in hilly terrain, and we were supposed to just go forward and see if we could find any activities at all. So I suggested that what we should do, each time we came to a hill, three should stay hidden, and the other one should go forward and look over this hill and see if there was anything there, anything to report. So that if there was anything there, you know, it wouldn't be four of us walking into a trap. Anyway, it came my turn to go forward, and I crawled up this hill. And as I put my head over the top, about 25 yards away was a cavalry patrol from the enemy. So I dived head first down the ditch, thinking they might have spotted me, dived down this ditch. Unfortunately, they hadn't seen me. And I went my way round this ditch until I was quite sure that they'd gone. And nearby was a farmhouse on fire. So I, being curious, I went down there, went into the farmyard, saw a couple of bodies there, saw that the place...